Hello there and welcome. Today is Wednesday, October 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, wildfires devastate California's wine country.
These embers were carrying over into neighborhoods and engulfing whole neighborhoods.
The bickering between a top Republican senator and the president continues. The EPA administrator says the war on coal is over. Also ahead, mounting accusations of sexual assault against a high-profile Hollywood producer. It's all on today's International Edition. It's being described as pure devastation in Northern California as flames that raced through across California's wine country have left little more than smoldering ashes and eye-stinging smoke. House after house is gone with only brick chimneys and charred laundry machines to mark sites that were once homes of families. Newly homeless residents of Northern California took stock of their shattered lives Tuesday while the blazes kept burning. Hundreds more firefighters joined the battle against the uncontained flames. President Trump commented on the tragedy on Tuesday.
As they deal with the tragic loss of life and property to devastating wildfires, I spoke with Governor Brown last night to let him know that the federal government will stand with the people of California, and we will be there for you in this time of terrible tragedy and need.
At least 100 people were injured during the blazes, and that started Sunday night. Nearly 200 were reported missing in Sonoma County alone. Fire crews and other resources were being rushed in from other parts of the state and Nevada. The fires moved quickly, so quickly that thousands were forced to flee without even just a few minutes of warning. Some didn't make it out in time. Joining me now is CAL FIRE Information Officer Heather Williams. Thank you for being with us. Tell us where things stand right now.
We are still looking at about 17 new fires that have started since Sunday late night. Approximately 115,000 acres has burned in that same time period.
Are any of them even close to being contained, or are they pretty much out of control at this point?
The good news is that the winds did die down overnight, and so we were able to get some containment on some of the fires, one of them in Nevada and Yuba. The sulfur fire that's in Lake County, the containment is actually at 10%, which is really good news on that fire. But the larger fires, the Tubbs and the Atlas fire, both in Napa County, while containment is still zero, the acreage was held overnight, which is good news. I mean, the fire didn't get any larger. Firefighters are going to be able to build up that containment, hopefully over the next day or so.
What about structures? I know a lot of homes have been lost.
We're estimating anywhere between 1,500 and 2,000 structures have been destroyed at this point. We still have damage assessment teams going in, so that number may go up over the next couple of days.
That's a lot of structures. Are a lot of those homes? It's my understanding that some entire neighborhoods were literally wiped out by this.
Very much it is a lot of homes, sadly, and winds can really carry embers, and embers land on these homes and ignite it. So while the fire was a mile away or so, these embers were carrying over into neighborhoods and engulfing whole neighborhoods, as we've seen in many pictures.
Any idea what started any of these fires?
No, not at this time. It's still under investigation.
I imagine that there's plenty of fuel. It's pretty dry.
Yeah, so with the rains that we had over the winter, they were really able to allow increased vegetation. I mean, we've had a drought previous, and so, you know, while everything was really dry year-round, there wasn't as much water to allow grass to grow during the spring, and like we've, you know, seen in California before. But California has a very hot and dry Mediterranean climate. So regardless, our vegetation always dries out. And so October, November are some of our most devastating months when it comes to wildfires.
Have you seen an increase in the past couple of years with the climate warming?
Our fire seasons are definitely longer than they were before. So with that does come, you know, a longer fire season and the potential for more damaging and devastating wildfires.
And what about fatalities?
These 15 that we've had, it is a very high number. And, you know, very much like the Valley Fire that started at night, it's that nighttime surprise, unfortunately, where people are already asleep. And so it's a, you know, evacuate now kind of sense of urgency. And so, unfortunately, I think that had a lot to do with why we've seen so many fatalities.
So there have been 15 so far just in this particular series of fires?
Correct, yeah.
And they were mostly people in their homes at night?
I wouldn't say that, but I think the fire starting at night, you know, people are at home and they're asleep and, you know, things like that. So I wouldn't say that that's what cause of why, because we don't know that. But, you know, the timing of the fire, most people, you know, it came as a surprise. And so firefighters, that was their priority that night, was getting people out, working alongside the law enforcement to help rescue people.
And are you calling in firefighters from all over the state or even outside of the state for these fires? Because it's pretty dramatic.
Yes, we definitely are utilizing our mutual aid system. We have firefighters, you know, from San Diego all the way up to the Oregon border. Our federal partners, the U.S. Forest Service, has brought in out-of-state resources from within the U.S. Forest Service to help California right now.
All right, well, these wildfires already rank among the five deadliest in California history, and officials expect the death toll to increase as the scope of the destruction becomes more clear. That was Cal Fire Information Officer Heather Williams. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Gunmen kill two in an attack on Kenya University students. Catalan leaders declare independence but will suspend implementation. Europe expects more terror attacks even as IS falters. Washington ponders ban of rifle accessories used by that Las Vegas shooter. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. President Donald Trump and fellow Republican Senator Bob Corker engaged in an extraordinarily pointed back and forth this week, with Trump saying the senator lacked guts and Corker replying that the White House had become an adult daycare center. Corker, a respected moderate who once supported Trump, has emerged in recent months as one of the president's most outspoken Republican critics. He recently said that the only presence of the generals in Trump's inner circle had kept the White House from descending into chaos. Trump made no mention of that remark in its tweets Sunday, but instead attacked Corker for his recent decision not to seek re-election, and saying that as chair of the Foreign Relations Committee, the Tennessee senator bore heavy responsibility for what Trump considers the deeply flawed nuclear deal with Iran. Joining me now to discuss, Jamil Jaffer, a former senior advisor to Senator Corker.
It's not usual for presidents to be fighting members of their own party as much as you might see in this administration. It does happen time to time, but it's not typical. And, you know, Twitter is a new way of communicating generally, or newer way. And so this sort of constant 140-character exchange between presidents and the public and presidents and Congress is a whole new phenomenon. This whole social media thing is all new. And we're seeing it play out sort of in real time.
My understanding is that you worked for Senator Corker?
That's right. I was the chief counsel and senior advisor to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee under Senator Corker, yes.
So you know him pretty well. He's a pretty straightforward guy, pretty reserved when it comes to things that he says. He seems very careful in what he says, and we haven't often heard things like we're hearing lately from him.
Yeah, all of those things. Senator Corker is reserved, careful, he's methodical, he thinks about what he says before he says it. He's also very straightforward and plain-spoken, which is to say he won't mince words and he won't, frankly, he won't BS people. He will tell you what he really thinks, and he'll be upfront about it. He'll be candid about it. That's sort of what he's known for. He's also a class act. He is not a given to saying mean things about people. He prides himself on being genteel. He's from the South in Tennessee, and that is the kind of man he is. And so what you're seeing here, I think, is a side of him that's been brought out by something that he's very deeply troubled and concerned about. And I actually think in a lot of ways, honestly, that he's trying to communicate with the president in a way that he hopes the president will listen and make the president more successful and do the business of the nation.
You mean by speaking indirectly to the president, but getting it out there that he's very concerned about some of the things he's seeing and hearing?
Yeah, I mean, I think he is trying to communicate with the president in the way I think he best knows how. Obviously, Senator Corker has numerous conversations with the president, but it appears that the president responds to things both positively and negatively when they appear in the media. And so, you know, that's part of what's going on here. I think there are challenges, as there are in any administration, maybe perhaps magnified here by 140 characters on Twitter. But make no mistake, the American people and the American government is united on confronting threats to our nation and will do so.
Well, Senator Corker also made some comments that he believes that the president's tweets are and what he called recklessness is threatening a potential World War III. That's a pretty serious statement.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think he is concerned that the tone and approach of the president's tweets is unusual enough that it might cause a miscalculation by one party or another. And you don't want, you know, when you're talking about nuclear weapons and states armed to the teeth, states that think they're still in a war with us, North Korea, you don't want a miscalculation. And to avoid that, if you can avoid, you know, using snarky terminology, that might be better.
Well, he also said that administration officials are really having a daily struggle to contain the president. There's been a lot of talk about the president being morally and psychologically unfit. These are words we have not heard.
Well, look, it's obviously a challenging time for the country right now. Clearly is a time when we need reconciliation. The U.S. is beset with challenges both domestically and abroad, and it's important that in this time we as a nation come together. And look, leadership begins at the top. And so the president has every responsibility to be responsible, to act wisely, to not, you know, get in conflicts with his own party in the Senate or within his own administration. And it's incumbent upon members of Congress to try and come together and work with the president to move the nation forward. Nobody wants Donald Trump to be unsuccessful, but, you know, lighting up members of your own party on Twitter is not going to move you in the direction of success. You know, it's interesting. You see President Trump using certain phraseology. He used it during the campaign, belittling people because of their physical appearance or the like. He's done that with Kim Jong-un. He did it with his opponents in the presidential election. And now he's doing it to people in the U.S. Senate. And the problem is, it's not like Senator Corker is the first person to experience this. Mitch McConnell, the majority leader in the Senate. John McCain, a war hero, a long leader in the Senate. Ben Sasse, a younger member, but obviously very accomplished. Now Bob Corker. And then members of his own administration, Rex Tillerson, Secretary of State, Jeff Sessions, who's been with him as Attorney General, and then prior to that on the campaign for a better part of a year. And so you're not going to be successful if you're not able to build bridges with your own people. You know, hopefully the president is hearing that from his staff, the folks around him. He's got really good folks around him, with John Kelly, Jim Mattis. There's a lot of really good, capable folks, and you got to listen to them and maybe stay off of Twitter for a little while.
You brought up a good point that Senator Corker also mentioned, and that was he felt like what was keeping the government in check was, in fact, Tillerson, Mattis, and Kelly. So if any of those men decide they've had enough, what happens then?
Well, look, I mean, the government is no one man or no one woman. That being said, I do think that people like H.R. McMaster, Secretary Tillerson, Secretary Mattis, you know, General Kelly, these are all very upstanding folks that had long careers in the U.S. government, long careers in U.S. industry. They're known as leaders and people of goodwill. And so, so I think that it's important the president listen to those people who are around him who've been successful, whether it's been in leading the military or leading in corporate America. That includes, by the way, Senator Corker, who was a very successful real estate developer, just like Donald Trump, and decided to serve his country, just like Donald Trump. And both of them, I think, are doing what they think is right for the country. But what gets in the way of that is sort of these personal squabbles. And we've got to have that stop happening. And at the end of the day, leadership starts at the top. The president knows that. We talked about it before. Now it's time to start effectuating that approach.
That's national security expert and former senior advisor to Senator Bob Corker, Jameel Jaffer. Thanks for being with us. Well, Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Scott Pruitt announced Monday the Trump administration will withdraw from the Obama-era Clean Power Plan. Addressing a crowd in Kentucky, Pruitt signed a proposed rule Tuesday to withdraw from the plan, which was aimed at slowing down global warming. A centerpiece of Obama administration's environmental policies, the Clean Power Plan, aimed to restrict greenhouse gas emissions from coal-fired power plants. Joining me now to talk more about this and what it means is Charlie Kolstad, senior fellow and professor at Stanford University. What do you make of this?
I did read over the announcement, and it's not just a short "we're going to withdraw," but a detailed plan for how they 2 points on which they plan to challenge Barack Obama's Clean Power Plan, challenge it as a mistaken action mistaken by the EPA that they're going to correct.
Well, what do they say is mistaken about it?
Well, they say that the law has been misinterpreted, that the law is supposed to apply not to states, which is how the Clean Power Plan is written. It directs each state to figure out its own way of reducing its emissions. But the Pruitt administration is saying that the law really requires each source, you know, each generating station to fiddle its emissions, which is a lot more restrictive because there's a lot fewer things that a single plant can do that you could do at a state level. So that's point number one. And then point number two, all major new rules and the Pruitt regulation that replaces the Clean Power Plan, I'm not sure who he's going to call it, also has to be subject to a cost-benefit analysis. So he's arguing that the Obama administration incorrectly estimated the harm from carbon emissions, and that when the Pruitt administration fixes that, then their new plan will pass the cost-benefit test. So he's sort of attacking it on two sides. One saying there's legal issues that weren't done wrong, and the second is that the calculation of the harm of carbon is wrong, and when they fix it, it'll call for much less control of greenhouse gases. Pruitt is in a little bit of a tough position in that the Supreme Court already passed back in 2008, I think, Massachusetts versus EPA. They already declared that it was okay for greenhouse gases to be subject to the Clean Air Act. So the EPA is being told by Congress, you've got to do something about greenhouse gases. He can't, I mean, that would be illegal to say, no, I'm not. That's his directive from the Congress. So the way he's got to do it is by the means that I just described, still doing something about greenhouse gases, but much less. It happens that two other things happened in almost the same week. Today I heard that the oil shale pipeline across Canada has been canceled by TransCanada. This is in the Keystone XL sphere of activities. And last week, the Department of Energy asked federal regulators if it was okay for them to pay coal plants to keep operating even if they weren't needed. So it's sort of a multi-pronged approach that has been threatened, I suppose, by the Trump administration ever since day one, or actually back from the campaign. Mm-hmm. To try to do something that's more pro-coal, and it seems to now be happening.
What is your view on what they're doing? Is it even possible to bring back coal? And it's widely documented that this is a very dirty source of energy, and that there are much more efficient and even economic at this point methods of energy. So why is it? What do you think is happening here?
I think the Trump administration is a mixture of ideology. You know, Pruitt has spent his life fighting these things, so you don't teach an old dog new tricks. But there's also, I think, a payoff to the interests that were backing President Trump. The main beneficiary is not coal miners. They're not going to get their jobs back. The main beneficiary is some of the owners of coal mines that have been very, very pro-Trump, and essentially a reward to them. But, you know, it's a mixture of ideology. I think Pruitt seriously believes that greenhouse gases are, people are overly alarmed about them. We see a lot of that, and I can't divine the true motivations for this. But one thing I do know is that when the government tries to go against the market, it usually gets burned. The market's pretty powerful, and the market is moving away from coal. Natural gas is cheap, and you know the writing is on the wall that energy, particularly for electric power in North America, is going to be inexpensive, and if you've been delaying retiring your coal plant, no point in delaying it much longer. So I think that's what's happening, and if they want to try to buck that trend, they're going to find that the market is more powerful.
That's Charlie Kolstad, senior fellow and professor at Stanford University. Earlier this year, the Trump administration pulled the U.S. out of the landmark 2015 Paris Climate Accord, saying it was unfair to the American people. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
VOA's International Edition continues now with what is trending on social media. And for that, we're joined by Andrew Palchevsky. Hey, Andrew, what's going on?
Well, one of the big tenets of social media and digital media is innovation. New things, whether it's virtual reality, new ways to communicate, new ways to shop online.
Right.
And so we're going to talk about a couple of those instances today. And the first one we're going to talk about is an innovation from Facebook that kind of backfired. You know, yesterday we talked about Dove and they had that Facebook ad where the woman who was African-American was turning into a white woman and people said it was racist. Well, Facebook has their own problem today.
Oh, boy.
They've announced earlier this week something called Facebook Spaces, where you can create a little avatar to go with virtual reality headsets, and it puts your little avatar wherever you are in the world looking through your virtual reality headset. So you can have your little person pop up in Paris or Peru or wherever. Well, Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO of Facebook, was showing this off, and he had his own little avatar that he had there. And he transported his avatar to Puerto Rico so he could look at the flooding and the devastation that is on the island after Hurricane Maria. Well, people did not like that. They said that he was basically a heartless billionaire, one person said. They said that he's using the tragedy to exploit Facebook and to promote Facebook. Now, Zuckerberg did announce as part of this introduction of Facebook Spaces that he is donating $1.5 million to the Red Cross, and Facebook will be helping them with some of their mapping for disaster relief and trying to find disaster areas. But perhaps not the best idea to transport your little person there to Puerto Rico while they're in the midst of dealing with that tragedy.
For sure, for sure. Anything else going on?
Yes. A happier innovation comes from Snapchat today. They have announced a new feature that will allow you to do everything from book a car service to book a restaurant to book a flight. It's part of the trend that we've seen more e-commerce coming into social media. So this is called Context Cards. And what it is you swipe up on Snapchat and there they are, the context cards where you can do all of these different things. Right now, it's only available in select countries like the US, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the UK, but it is going to be rolled out globally. I think it's only a matter of time before we see more and more companies getting in on this. We've seen Facebook embrace e-commerce. We've seen Twitter embrace ways that you can connect and interact with different companies. And now add Snapchat to that list.
All right, Andrew, thank you so much. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. And turning now to the latest Hollywood news. Well, there's been an avalanche of allegations pouring out against Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein, including testimonies from Gwyneth Paltrow and Angelina Jolie, which only intensified the already explosive collapse of the disgraced movie mogul. Three women accused Weinstein of raping them in a story published online by The New Yorker. The New York Times also reported Tuesday that many other actresses have had in recent days added to the choir of accusations. Weinstein was fired Sunday from his own company, The Weinstein Company. In a statement on Twitter on Tuesday, Hillary Clinton weighed in, saying she was shocked and appalled by the revelations, and she praised the women for coming forward. And now for more on this, we're joined by Rare.us content editor Nicole Michella. Nicole, more and more celebrities speaking out on this.
Yeah, we have Meryl Streep, who has previously been like at award shows applauding Harvey Weinstein and making jokes about how he's such a great producer and all of that. But in the amid all of these allegations, she has come out and said that she is appalled to hear that he would behave in such a way, and that she said not everybody knew and that she didn't know. So clearly she didn't experience anything that other actresses, including Ashley Judd, Gwyneth Paltrow came out with accusations. She said that something happened when she was 22, where she accused Harvey Weinstein of trying to get her to go into his hotel room for a massage. Angelina Jolie was a little more vague in her accusation. She just said that something bad happened, a bad experience happened, and she has never worked with him since. So there are a lot of big-time Hollywood stars who are coming out with these accusations at this time.
Sounds like a serial sexual predator. I mean, and maybe his power in the entertainment industry. Nobody wanted to tell anybody else what happened, so everybody kept quiet, and it just finally came to a head here.
Yeah, definitely. And I know, or I've been hearing at least, that he may have paid some women off in the past. So this is something that's really appalling to a lot of people. It's really shaken Hollywood.
Wow, unbelievable. So you do have a little bit of lighter news, just sort of some gossip about Miley Cyrus and her her romance with on-again, off-again fiancé Liam Hemsworth. What's up with that?
Yeah, so they broke up back in 2013 after 3 years together. They ended their engagement. Everybody thought that they were going to, like, ride off into the sunset and have this beautiful Hollywood romance. And she kind of went a little crazy. You know, she was twerking and sticking her tongue out, and people were upset about it. They reconciled in 2016, and they're re-engaged, so that's very exciting. But she did a recent interview on the Howard Stern Show, where she admitted that she felt like the two of them were codependent. And she said she doesn't like the feeling of having two halves forcing each other to become one. So they decided to end things, take a little break, be apart, and she doesn't regret anything. I guess she feels like she's grown and he grew while they were apart, and now they're two halves that are seamlessly coming together instead of trying to force it.
So are they still engaged?
Oh, yeah, but there are no wedding plans, public wedding plans that we know of yet. A lot of people are constantly on the lookout for whether or not she's wearing another ring or he's wearing a ring. Actually, she did a funny interview, I think it was last year, on the Ellen DeGeneres Show, where she said she really likes to wear very eccentric kind of jewelry, things that look like they're made out of candy and stuff like that. But she wears this classic diamond ring he gave her because of the symbolism that's behind it and because he gave it to her. So it's the only piece of, like, traditional jewelry Miley has.
All right, thanks so much, and thank you all for listening to International Edition. We thank our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is deeply troubled by the September 27th conviction and two-year prison sentence for Crimean Tatar leader Ilmi Umerov in Russian-occupied Crimea. Mr. Umerov was convicted for his opposition to Russia's attempted annexation of Crimea and given a harsher sentence than the Russian occupation prosecutor requested. This compounds past injustices in the case, said State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert, including his confinement for several weeks of punitive psychiatric treatment in 2016. Human Rights Watch condemned this confinement as an egregious violation of his rights. Speaking at his trial, Umerov said that the charges against him were to punish all who oppose the annexation. He vowed to appeal his sentence all the way to the European Court of Human Rights. Umerov's lawyer, Nikolai Polozhev, says he fears that the Russian prison system will not be capable of providing proper medical care to Umerov, who has Parkinson's disease, diabetes, and heart disease. The European Union called Umerov's sentencing a serious violation of his human rights and another example of persecution of the Crimean Tatar community and a further and clear illustration of the severe deterioration of human rights on the Crimean Peninsula. The Ukrainian government condemned the verdict as an illegal and politically motivated sentence that violated Umerov's human rights. Umerov is a deputy chairman of the Majlis, the Crimean Tatars' elected representative body, and has been an outspoken critic of Russia's purported annexation of Crimea and its crackdown on Crimean Tatars. Umerov's conviction follows similar rulings in Crimea on September 10th, against deputy head of the Crimean Tatar Mejlis, Akhtem Chihos, and on September 22nd against Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty contributor Mykola Semena. The United States calls on the Russian occupation authorities to immediately release Umerov and vacate his conviction. Crimea remains an integral part of Ukraine, and the United States remains steadfast in its support for the territorial integrity and sovereignty of Ukraine.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.